I didn't realise that. I mean, so...
Yes, sir. March on, and we're all gone on and that all the time.
Was that Mrs. Pankhurst's idea to have the Marseillaise, do you think?
I don't know whose idea came, that things were picked up and were taken hold of so quickly.
Yes.
But we were all for that.
I hadn't realised. So the March of the Women wasn't a sort of
theme
song? That
didn't come until quite later. It wasn't very much liked by a lot of people at all. Other people didn't like the words. And the other one was very... Well, I wonder whether you could get them somewhere.
Yes, I mean, I got the words. What was wrong with the words? What did you dislike about them?
Our words of the Marseillaise were our own words, not the words of the Marseillaise.
Yes, yes. But why did you dislike the words of the March for Women?
I don't know. When we were young, I think we thought they were rather sentimental, squawking.
I see. Yes, I hadn't realised.
I was with Mrs. Pankhurst when the first time that Ethel Smythe conducted her, what do you call it?
Band?
Her
march?
Not her march, but her first...
Symphony?
What?
Symphony?
Yes.
Yes.
And I remember very, very well, she interested me as a young woman very much. She was very eccentric, the way she did things.
Yes. Did they get her right on the programmes, do you
think? Did you hear her? No, she wasn't good at all. And it made a lot of these people appear much older than they were. For instance, I didn't have to do with all the pictures that went into Unshackled. I was in America. And they chose a picture of Ethel Smythe years older than she looked when
yes.
I knew her.
Yes.
Ethel Smythe was a delightful person. Did you hear the thing yesterday in the middle of the day?
Dame Marjorie Corbett Ashby was on, wasn't she?
No, yesterday Ethel Smythe was on.
Oh, was she? No, I didn't
yes.
hear that.
And
no.
She's been on there before. They tell about all the women sort of looking up, and then there is Ethel Smythe with her toothbrush directing from the prison, inside the prison like that with her toothbrush, like that, and all these women are singing.
She was great fun.
Oh, she's great fun, absolutely great fun.
Yes.
And they went on telling about later on how she became a great friend of Virginia Woolf's. But it ended up by saying that really her first love was Mrs. Pankhurst.
Yes, yes. Well, they were personal friends, weren't they?
Oh, they were
really?
Very close. But
yes.
Of course they said all sorts of things to each other and they disagreed. I used to very often be at luncheons when they were both there and hear them talking about music. And then what Ethel Smythe thought about music and what Mrs. Pankhurst thought about music. Mrs. Pankhurst was so, so 100% British, she wouldn't listen to any German music. And she didn't like it and it was really interesting to hear them.
But you think...
I was sympathetic with Ethel Smythe. I thought, you know...
That's interesting, because you'd think Mrs. Pankhurst would be in favour of French music, really.
Oh yes, she was very pro-French.
Yes.
I come of a pro-French family too. I'm much more pro-French than anything else.
It's a rather important thing in Mrs. Pankhurst's whole life, isn't it? The fact
you see, she was at school there, and I remember meeting, let me see now, Madame Adam. She was over 100, I think, when she died, and she was... the headmistress of the school, of Mrs. Pankhurst's school, when she was in France. And she also held sort of soirees with all sorts of interesting people there. She was awfully interesting.
So Mrs. Pankhurst had kept in touch with
her?
Oh
yes, and Christabel used to go and see her.
I see, I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Yes. Because you tend to forget
then
her
Then I was
French.
In America and I saw her death. I know she was over 100 when she died.
It's interesting. You say your family is more pro-French.
Yes.
Why is it? Because it's Irish connection, I suppose, partly, is it?
Well, I don't know. My mother was very pro-French and very... She didn't respond to the Germans. She was very both French and Italian. She liked Italy very much. And she didn't like... She said to you, I remember when I was very, very tiny, hearing her say that she wouldn't allow me to be taught German. It was a very guttural sounding language.
Interesting, yes. And so when you went over to France to see Christabel, you felt quite at home in France.
I feel at home. I don't speak French, but I'm quite at home. I'm very, very at home with the French people.
That's interesting. You mentioned your grandfather, your Irish grandfather, being very humane sort of
very,
person.
Very.
Was he? He sounds almost like a Quaker. What was he?
No, he was rarely a Church of England, but low.
Evangelical sort of. Yes, yes.
But he's very broad for his day. You know, that period of time when I was growing up, some of the people were very broad about religious things, and indeed we had some very interesting people alive at that time.
So he wasn't anti-Catholic or bitterly?
No, not anti-anything like that at all, no. No, I'm a mixture. My eldest aunt married a Catholic, Roman Catholic. And I was very fond of his people. He had a sister who was, well, she was much older than me, but she seemed very young in comparison to him. And we were great friends.
Yes, you went to, you remember when you went to the Hyde Park demonstration in 1908?
Yeah.
You went with your favourite aunt, didn't you? Can you tell me a bit about your favourite aunt?
Well, she was brought here, my grandmother had a very large family, and two of them, one named Grace and the other named Ina, they were adopted by an aunt in Southern Ireland, a great aunt of mine. And she sort of brought them up, and they've come over a great deal. She was very attractive and very very interesting woman.
Was she a suffragette?
She was very interested in us, but I know one day I wrote a letter and said that I was on the verge of getting to a meeting, but my grandmother had had a heart attack, and I couldn't go, and I was very annoyed about it. And she wrote back and said, well, thank goodness for that. She said, you'll be in jail by now. And she was very interested indeed. I think she saw it in my hand. She was very good at palm reading. She never would say, but they all could see something, I think.
That's interesting, yes.
She was very interesting because, you know, she told me afterwards, she said, she saw so many, especially the men, of their lives broken off. And she said she could see the war coming.
She really, yes. Yes. Did she teach you how to read people's palms?
No, she didn't. She was very naturally good at it. She used to do it at bazaars, you know, church bazaars and that kind of thing. She was what you would call quite religious, but she liked high church better than low. Of course, it was very low, and if you had one extra candle in Ireland, you were gone to the devil almost.
Yeah, I can believe that. Your grandmother was a bit of a rebel, wasn't she? Who was ill, you nursed. She was a bit of a rebel herself.
My Irish grandmother.
Yes.
Well, she was delightful, absolutely delightful, and she was such a help to young people who were having all sorts of problems. She'd talk with them. They come tiptoeing in, and they'd go out looking awful, and coming out saying, "Oh, she'd smoothed out all their worries for them."
How did she do it? What was the knack she had?
She
had a knack of relieving people's troubles.
Well, I think, yes, I think she was, I think she'd lived a very interesting life. She'd had a very large family, she was able to advise them, I think, very often.
Just very wise person.
Yes, very wise. And also with a great sense of humour. Great sense of humour.
Sort of mischievous, really.
Yes.
That's interesting. She obviously took a delight in what the suffragettes were doing, didn't she?
She listened to the whole thing.
It must have been a great support for you to have somebody in the family who backed you up, you know.
Well, they were all very good, except, of course, I think my father was very worried about rests and that kind of thing. But I didn't go away to be an organizer, and I didn't do anything until after my grandmother died. I sort of living twixt and between.
Do you think you would have, do you think if she hadn't died then, do you think you would ever have gone to prison at all?
Oh yes, I think it would have had to, I would have, I was destined for what I did. I knew I had something to do when I was a child, when I was very, very small.
Mm.
I didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something or other I had to do.
Mm. Yes, I mean, you say you've always been a woman.
You see, I sort of can't describe it to you, except that I sort of came into incarnation, I would say, knowing that there was something other that I had to do, but I didn't know what it was. And there are pictures of me. There's one of me I know with my eldest brother who died many years ago. He was a year younger than myself. And we were sitting together, and I even know what I was thinking then. All the time, what am I going to do when I grow big? I was absolutely intense about it.
Mm. Mm.
And my aunt was very broad, my favorite, all my aunts were very broad. I mean, I haven't come in with problems with the family. They were there and very nice to meet, and didn't, if you they weren't there, you don't bother, a kind of thing. And I haven't been pulled back in any way by them. Of course, they all think I'm eccentric. And
do they? I mean,
I think they all, yes. And there was a great argument, and was Helen Pettigrew's second wife, and my father, not my father, my brother, my young brother was alive now, he's a doctor, and Helen said, oh, you know, she doesn't eat properly, you know, and she said this, that, and the other, and all the rest of it. Well, they argued about this for a long time, and then presently my brother said, and rather drove, well, she seems to be very well on it.
Did your parents give your brothers first pick of everything? I mean, were your brothers put above you?
I was the eldest.
Yes, but I mean, in some families, the boys are given the best, aren't they, of everything?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think it was very fair the way it was done.
Mm. They didn't discriminate against you because you were a girl?
No, not at all.
Mm. So you don't feel...
No, I think I was rather the other way, because my father was very, very much what you might call, I suppose, a ladies' man. He liked women, and he had a very charming manner with them, and he was very Irish in a way, although he didn't like that people think he was Irish, but he was.
So he made sure you were looked after properly?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
No, I think I got the best of it.
So, I mean, your attachment to women's suffrage or women's rights goes right back beyond that. I mean, it's not as though it grew up out of resentment at the way you were treated
no
in the family
at all. No.
I mean,
except I was horrified about certain things that I saw that upset me very much.
What sort of things?
Well, I remember one of our servants, maids, I'd call a young maid, got into trouble. She was pregnant, and I was very young indeed. Of course, my mother died when I was 12, and I went off to the home that they put her in. I did up my hair, dressed myself to look, as I hoped, quite old, and I went in there, and the woman in charge looked absolutely horrified, and I was so upset with what I saw there on this unmarried mother's home, and the treatment that they received absolutely got me.
What happened?
Well, I felt, you see, that they were, you know, the woman came off so badly, and the man got scot-free.
Mm.
I remember it made a very great impression upon me.
How did they treat the women? Did they treat them as if they were prisoners?
Well, they were always treated as if there was something, you know, wrong with them. It might almost be criminal the way they treated them.
Mm. That sort of thing does strike a child, doesn't it?
Very strongly.
Mm. Mm.
I was shocked.
Mm. Did your father take her back into the family
we got her thing, and the most amusing part was I again dressed myself up to look old, and went to see someone, very, very charming woman she was, to give the reference. And she was so entertained at my youthfulness that she wrote a letter to my father about it. I suffered very much from looking too young. And I used to think, if only I was 30, they'd listen to me. But they didn't. The vote was, there was not won then.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? And people, when they look older than they are discontented, but when they feel older than they look, they're also discontented. Yeah. People are never satisfied.
Well, I was so much so that when I was in East Anglia, I had rather difficulty because I looked very young. And but I had a handwriting, rather a good handwriting in those days, it's gone to the devil now. And I used to write to people, and when they saw me, they thought I was much older. When they'd just seen my handwriting, they thought I was much older than I looked.
Of course, all the suffragettes were young, weren't they? I mean, that was one of the attractions of the movement, in a way, wasn't it?
I think some of the women who were older, they were very handsome women. I think a very interesting thing now, I've never followed it up too much, but the Brackenburys, who were very interesting people, I remember them talking about some of us and saying, you know, the suffragettes have got a different shaped face. You see, it seemed as if we belonged to people who had, my father had a Roman nose. I seemed to be different. I had a width here, and they're more even between the, you know, the three, they're more even, instead of being longer. And they noticed that so many of the young ones who really seemed to be going to do something had this change of feature.
Oh.
And they talked about the suffragette face.
Extraordinary. Mind you, you took trouble with your appearance as well, the suffragettes, didn't they? I mean,
well, you see, we rather felt that it was, in fact, the Pankhursts were very particular about that. They felt that we were doing very extreme things, therefore we ought to be very conventional. And I would be far more particular than I would have been if I hadn't been a suffragette. And I was rather clever in a way, because I used to have the colour slightly brought into an evening dress, or a very, very tiny brooch that was quite attractive, very little with a thing on. Creates a stir. I'd go to a bridge party, and the bridge party was nearly broken up once because of this suffragette.
You put on the colours?
Yes. I wore the colours all the time. It was very unusual then, but I didn't wear them in the extreme colour. You know, I wore the colours, but not in the colour of the flag exactly, which was so very bright. But that was Mrs. Lawrence who started that. They were very clever organisers, the Lawrences were. They were very keen on our all being dressed in the colours. If we weren't, they were after us in a minute. But Mrs. Pankhurst had a great feeling for clothes, very particular. What she'd have said about the way the women dress today, I can't imagine. And she showed it in a very funny way, I mean to say, very thin. She disapproved of the way somebody's dressed. She put no notice on them at all, and she'd turn round. She liked the way I dressed, and you could see by the way she did it that you know, she approved of me, didn't approve of the others. And I said, well, you've got to be awfully careful to some of the young ones. I said, she doesn't like that style of dress.
That's interesting. What styles did she particularly dislike?
Well, she didn't like them when they were very, of course, now we wear sweaters all the time, but they wore these sweaters and they were very, very short of breasty, if you know what I mean. She didn't like that at all.
She was quite old-fashioned, really.
Oh, very Victorian.
Yes.
Very.
That's interesting. Did she, supposing...
And I was at the most advanced school, wearing the shortest costume that had ever been worn at the time. They called us the Bloomer Girls, and our bloomers came just a little below the thing, and they were all Liberty costumes. It was brown and with sort of green smock. And we were quite different from the others. But still I came out all right, I seemed to know how to.
Yes, well, you still do. And you still got that sort of ability to put something on which brings out the colour in what you're wearing. But supposing, Some people joined the movement who didn't have any dress sense, I imagine. Did Mrs. Pankhurst try and give them an idea of what to wear?
No, she didn't. No, she never. No, she never talked. It was, anything she did was. But I remember one girl that was I thought a great deal of, and she became very prominent afterwards. She was a friend of mine, and I said at once, "Oh, you mustn't wear that. You must wear something else." Because we have to be very careful. Yes.
Hmm. Christabel, of course, was very conscious of her dress as
well. Oh yes,
wasn't
she? We were. The Pankhursts liked us to be, and I think they were quite right.
I agree. I mean, because the men wanted to give the impression that you were female, not feminine.
Yes.
You know. Yes.
We probably, really and truly, we came into a room. A suffragette who was, you know, knew what she was doing and knew her stuff, she would be the best dressed person in the room. Not in expensive clothes, but she would know how to dress.
But when you broke up your bridge party, when you wore the colours, what did people say then?
Oh, I could hear they were talking. I can't remember what they said, but they were absolutely terrific.
They knew what the colours meant, didn't they?
Oh, yes. They knew what the colours meant so much. I remember going with my father to Switzerland, and that must have been in 1912, because about the only holiday I ever had. And I was very tired. I just finished the Getting Mary Lear released, and I landed with her in London, and then I dashed straight off because I was told that other things were coming for me and I must go away and get some rest right away. Well, I remember that I'd been given a travelling rug, and it had just a little tiny touch of the purple and the green in, very delicately put in, beautiful Scotch rug. And everybody knew as I was travelling about it, and they recognised the colours.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, then we went through a time at the end, you see, where you couldn't wear the colours at all. That when the revolution started, you had to be quite the other way, you see. You had to, you couldn't wear the colours. And this happened at the same time that Annie Kenney was in Bristol, and I came from East Anglia, and we arrived at Clement's Inn together, and Jessie was there, and she absolutely burst into it. She said, "Anna's just been here and she's got a navy suit, just like you." I said, "Well, we can't wear the colours anymore, you know." And then Annie came in, and Annie was the sweetest thing. She'd always dance if she was very pleased. She was just very young, almost like a child. But Annie suffered terribly from her last hunger strike, which I felt so closely in touch with her. I don't think anybody realised how bad it was. And she never really got over it.
So she didn't dance about
later
on.
Well, it wasn't that she
so much.
Well, she lost her figure, and she was not herself quite the same way again. One of whom acted as her housekeeper and was with me a great deal when I was in hiding, Louis Hatfield. She said to me one day, she said, "She's not the same since her last hunger strike." It was quite true.
Tell me about Louis Hatfield. Actually, I haven't come across her.
Louis
at all.
Hatfield. I don't know that you'll come to it at all. She was a let me see now, how could I describe her? She was charming to look at, but very pink and white, and she got TB.
Oh.
And she had very small hands and very small feet. And somehow or other she was always working for Annie, cooking for Annie. She was there and she knew everything about the movement. And she was a very good go-between, you see, because she was absolutely safe. And sometimes Mrs. Bartlett did it, and sometimes Louis Hatfield. And Louis Hatfield was with me in my escaping period when I went from one thing to another. She was with me. It just so happened that as I walked into Annie's flat, saying, as I said, "I don't know, but I don't think I can go back to where I'd been," I said, "I'm quite sure I'd be arrested." And I found that she was so taken up with her trial that she wasn't thinking about any of the things that got to be done. I told her that, and Annie said, Well, act on your intuition. Don't go back like that. That moment, Louis Hatfield popped her head in the door, and she said, "I've just heard that the flat that Grace was in has been raided."
Mm.
It was less than half an hour after I'd left.
Mm.
And Annie said, "Oh, well, why don't you go to some place in near the British Museum, somewhere there, one of the hotels there, and take Louis with you." So Louis was with me through the part when I was passing from one thing to the other. She was a marvelous person. And she was very unnoticed by everybody. I mean, she could go walk into anywhere and nobody thinks she... They wouldn't think she was anybody. Do you know what I mean? There are some people who are like that. And she was a marvelous person.
So was she in a way a sort of servant to
you? Well, she was a... nobody was a servant in with us, but she was a...
assistant.
She was just looked after Annie, and and she had somebody there that she could know everything. It was quite safe. It's wonderful to get people like that.
I understand, yes.
And Mrs. Bartlett was the same.
Yes, tell me about Mrs. Bartlett. I haven't come across her.
Mrs. Bartlett was in the movement from the very, very early days. She's what, in the terms, is called a working woman. She's a wonderful person. She was the first person when I went to the office that somebody said, "Would I like to distribute leaflets?" And Mrs. Bartlett came with me. She came back and gave a killing account of me. I was very well dressed as if I was at one of my grandmother's homes, in the colours, with a white ermine collar, and a green hat, was very up to date, and the whole thing in sort of a dark green like this. And I went out up down Regent Street and Bond Street, and I gave these hands out, and I gave them as if I was handing a cup of tea to somebody in my grandmother's drawing room, like that. And everybody's thinking for all like that. She, why, they said it, she, no, everybody took it, her hand, but they said no, everybody, she said, took it from me. You never saw anything like it. Well, I said I was doing them a great honour in handing them that leaflet, getting them in touch with the suffragettes.
It must have been rather fun going out with a working woman like that, wasn't it? I mean, because you presumably didn't normally go out with working women.
Well, she didn't look what you call a working woman in that way, quite. But she was that... There was so much class distinction. I don't... She didn't... She was just the tops to me.
Mm.
And she was in the... there was a one time... It was a bad accident that didn't come off. I can't remember what it was. And I think it was at Portsmouth. And we were all down there. A very interesting crowd down there. Rosamund Massey and Margaret Cameron and Rachel Barrett, and there were all sorts of people there. I was quite on the early stages of things. I was sent down there, and there were an awful type of man there, and we were in a temperance hotel, and we went out the first night to, it was a mob, of course, the boats were in, and there were lots of the sailors and all that sort of thing. We all went out to different places. And I went with somebody that you may not have heard of yet, Maud Joachim. She was the niece of Prince Joachim, the violinist.
Yes.
And she was a blue stocking. But she was had a very intern personality. And I fancy that she must have had a very hard early childhood in some way. I feel this person who suffered a great deal. She was very clever, and she got everything at her fingertips, but she hadn't got the gift of giving it out. And I was always being sent with her. I had quite a time. And I got up, not being able to speak very much, I got up and shouted to a crowd of hundreds, literally hundreds. Now, Mrs. Bartlett was at the end of this crowd. The wind was behind me, and she said, over all their shouting and everything, she said, you could hear my voice like a bell coming right over. I had a very good voice then. And I went on like that, and finally, she was the speaker, and I tried to get her on, and she called me Rowlett. She said, "Rowlett, you'll have to go back again." And she couldn't do anything with it. I can understand it. She was gifted, but she had got the personality to put it over like that. But things got very, very hot. Suddenly they started tipping the lorry we were on, you see, like that. And suddenly I looked round and I saw, when the lorry went, that my friend Bård Joachim was being tipped right off the lorry. And I saw about 6 or 7 very fine working men come right up and close round her. And I thought, well, now she's all right. Then I think the thing was going like that. And I went as if I was just going to take a swim. And I jumped into the crowd like that, and I was completely surrounded by sailors. And you don't know how difficult, what an awful mob it was. They did tear the clothes right off some of our people. But when I came back, well, first of all, they took me right through the crowd. They then got me onto a streetcar. They then sort of dropped off. And finally, when I got to the committee rooms, there was just one with me. And when I got there, they had to have police on both sides because they were trying so hard to get us. Then there was only about 200 or 300 yards to get to the hotel. And the police were all the way down the way. And I was taken down and I went in. When I got into a very large, you know, one of these sort of dining rooms there that they had, and there was a fire, I remember, burning, and everybody looked terribly worried. And there was a young reporter there, and he sort of came forward to me, and I saw the face of Mrs. Massey looked something awful. She looked white with, you know, like that as I came in, and they said, what has happened to me, you see? I said, oh, I said, I had a marvellous time. I was carried through the crowd by sailors, like that. Well, the organizer of the whole campaign, Margaret Cameron, said, oh, what will Christabel say? And all these awful things that had happened. It was terrible. And the next day, nothing got into the London press, but the Daily Excursion said, Miss Grace Rose carried through the crowd by sailors. But we had the ghastly things really happened that day. They all had a dreadful time.
But they were looking after you, these sailors,
but
really?
After that, after this particular time when you know, when we went out in the day and everything, the sailors had all gone, my sailors had all gone, but there were working men there, and we had to protect some of the speakers who wanted to ask questions. Now, let him ask his question. They were there ready to pounce on anybody who did anything to us at all. Now, it was really wonderful, because it was such a marvellous stage. Here was this... you know, it couldn't be riotous treatment. And they almost kissed the hem of your garment at the end. And that was in a week. It was a terribly interesting psychological thing.
And that was in Portsmouth?
Yes, in Portsmouth.
Mm. Mm.
But some of them suffered terribly.
Mm. Well, you said you suffered terribly in Ipswich later, didn't you, when you were an organiser in Ipswich. There were a lot of hostile mobs there too.
I don't remember that, was it?
You were East Anglian organiser, weren't you?
Yes.
Later on.
Oh,
there was a lot of hostility,
well,
wasn't there?
Well, I don't think it was actually in Ipswich itself.
Hmm.
I think it was... I was in campaigns with Mrs. Pankhurst. And I know Mrs. Pankhurst, sometimes we used to put... you know, some lady, somebody or other in the chair, you know, just come in. Mrs. Packer said, I don't want any of those people in there. All they do is lose the audience for me. She said, I'd like you to take the chair for me at these meetings. So whenever I could, I was working very hard, I turned up and, oh yes, I know what you want to know about. And I turned up there and I just used to shout. And I could go on doing this until suddenly the crowd quieted down and then handed over to Mrs. Pankhurst. And I know there was one place, but it wasn't Ipswich, it was in Derbyshire, after the, that 29, was it, or 1909 deputation.
Oh yes, yes.
Well, the case was taken to the higher courts and many of us went to the High Peak Division, because it was an election was on at the time. And I was with Mrs. Mansell and Mrs. Frank Corbett and Mrs. Marshall and all these people who'd come in for the first time. It was the first time they were arrested, you know, and Mrs. Mansell was a lovely person. She was a relative of Churchill's and great liberal, come out of the Liberal Party. And the type for, as we young people would say, for the drawing room meeting, but not capable of handling the crowds. Well, I went with her, and I was still rather inclined to wear a hockey outfit. And I got there, and I got all the crowds around me, from all the different parties that were there. They all came around. And you couldn't hear a word, and I simply waved my arms and said, "We are the suffragettes, we are the suffragettes, we are the suffragettes," like that. This went on, and Mrs. Mansell was saying, "Splendid," she couldn't hear a word I was saying, "Splendid, splendid, splendid," she was whispering all the time. Silently the thing died down, and I was able to hand her over like that.
And you had ideas about stewarding meetings, didn't you, as well, when you were early on?
Yes.
What were your ideas about?
Well, I liked everybody to be in white and, you know, very carefully dressed, and I had them all placed very carefully. I had used a great many stewards. We did. I mean, I thought they were part of the whole. Just the way that I wanted the flowers around the platform and the flowers for Christabel and if anybody was out of key, I didn't like it at all.
So you're quite a perfectionist about organizing
everything
meetings.
Like that. Yes, you see, I feel that people who are very filled with ideas and very good speakers, they need all their strength for that. They haven't got the strength to do the other. Therefore, some of our organizers were very good speakers, but very poor at the organizing end, and the others, and I'm afraid very few, were what I call absolutely out for the organizing and wouldn't speak.
Mrs. Pankhurst wasn't an organizer, really, was she?
No, she was an evangelist.
Yes, I mean, she wouldn't be bothered with...
But she knew if a meeting had been properly run and the work had been properly done. She was the most critical person about the meeting.
Was she?
Very critical. She could tell you what educational work had been done in the audience and everything.
Could she really?
Oh, no, she was very particular about her meetings. I had very fortunate, because I really was with Mrs. Pankhurst a great deal in the meetings. She liked all the stewarding to be done well, and she liked to be properly looked after in the speaker's room, and I wouldn't allow anybody to go in and see her before she went on the platform, because she was, it was extemporary with her. She had no notes whatsoever, and if somebody came in and they said something rather to her before, they could put her off her feet, and she might talk about something that she'd really not intended to talk about. And I realized that without ever saying it to her. And she was very pleased, and I said, "No, I don't let anybody in to see you until afterwards, if you want to see them."
Was she nervous?
Yes, she said she was always nervous. I remember in the war, there was a lot of meetings at, I think it was called Palladium. At any rate, in the middle of all this music hall stuff that we had in those days, they had 3 minutes put on for Mrs. Pankhurst to come and speak on recruiting. And I was in the wings, and I was supposed to give her a sign at a certain time when the 3 minutes was up. And one night she went on, and she had been on speaking about a minute, and I went like that. And finally at the end she'd come off at about 2.5 minutes. And she said, the lights, she couldn't bear the lights. What she'd have done with these modern days and all this television stuff. It's very hard on the eyes.
Yes. But did she enjoy a meeting once it had started?
Oh, yes, she enjoyed her meeting. She enjoyed it. She was absolutely lost in the thing. But you really had got to do good work and get the crowd ready for her. Another thing I often used to do, I'd go through the crowd if it was going to be someone, and I'd say, you see the clapping was, you tipped them up all over the place, and then it got one clapping for about 10 minutes. It's catching. But you've got to work those things up a bit.
Did she, after the meeting was over, was she very exhausted usually? Did she get very tired?
Well, that depended. During the Wisbech election, she was very, very bad state of health. That's why she was in the one constituency all the time. And, well, she lived on raw eggs and grapes. Actually, nothing else, and you'd feed her sometimes we were going along in the car. She'd sometimes speak even five times in an evening, but she was pretty exhausted.
Mm.
But Christabel had a great way of covering us all up. She didn't want anybody to know too much about our physical ailments. She felt she wouldn't put it past the government making use of it.
Mm.
But Mrs. Pankhurst was a wonderful person. Of course, she had Nurse Pine with her nearly all the time. If she saw anybody, rather, she was almost in bed before they'd, you know, resting immediately after they'd gone.
Yes.
And yet, when anything had to be done, there she was.
Yes, at the crucial moment.
Yes, at the but she lived for those moments.
Yes.
But, of course, a lot of people may not understand it. They were so wonderful in Paris, because particularly, because they did it no doubt at other times, but I saw them so much at that time. They knew how to rest themselves, and they were always advising us. They thought we were much too tense, whispering, come along out and, you know, do this. We fooled around in shops and, you know, picked out, went to concerts. And anything that was special going on, we went to. I went with Mrs. Pankhurst and Christabel very often. And Mrs. Pankhurst undoubtedly not only rested, but very often picked up an idea through what she was hearing. And if there was anything very special that we had to do, Christabel would say, now, just feel free to do whatever you want. Just don't do anything except what you want to do. And she told Annie this too. And wait until, you know, you got the interview. And in the war, we had to interview. There were about five of us who were interviewing cabinet ministers and members of the House of Lords all the time. And Christabel would want some answer. She wanted to know about something, I think. When I went, I don't know what the others did, I used to let them talk. I would let them talk all the time until it got very near the end, and then I'd pop in this thing. Well, I don't know why we couldn't do that, sort of thing like that. And the funny thing was, it used to rest the person you went to see, and they'd say, do come again and see me soon, because, you know, I feel so much better after I talk to you. They've done all the talking.
yes, that's interesting. But she has a sort of zest for life, Mrs. Pankhurst, doesn't she?
Zest for life? Oh,
yes, a sort of joie de vivre.
So. Life is joy. It was joy to her. She did enjoy life.
Yes.
Very, very much. Yes. The end, I think, of her life must have been very hard. I was in America when she died.
Hmm. Did
she was very fond of us all. I remember one day she went to met somebody in Regent Street, and she said, can you tell me anything about Grace? And she said, oh, yes, she said, I've just had a letter from Charlie Marsh. And they're together, you know, in San Francisco. Oh, said Mrs. Packer's face all lit up. She said, I never mind when there are two of them together. You see, in a way, we had a pretty hard time because people were so down on us at the end, you couldn't get anything. It was very hard to get a job, all that sort of thing.
Tell me about Charlie Marsh. It's Charlotte Marsh, isn't it?
Charlotte Marsh.
Yes. Tell me about her, because you've often mentioned her.
Well, she was one of the early ones that came in on the forceful feeding in the early days, sort of the Connie Lytton time.
Mm, 1909, that sort of period, 1910.
Yeah. And she was a wonderful person.
Because she was the cross-bearer.
Yes, she was the cross-bearer, yes.
Mm. But what sort of family did she come from?
Well, she came from a very nice family in Newcastle, and I think she must have been her father's pet, because it was something rather tragic about her. I never got it exactly from her, although I knew her very well. But she was released at a very funny time, and she walked back to the house And her father, when she got there, her father died. And it made, I think it made her very kind of reserved, and, you know, you couldn't get very much out of her. But we were a lot together, especially at the latter part of her life. And I saw her too in America. We were very funny. If anything went wrong, either with me or with her, we were together somehow. And then we wouldn't see each other again for months. But always if something other was happening, we were there. It was quite interesting.
Did she have a job at all?
She was an organizer. She was, before that, she had worked in Selfridges, in the, I don't know what they called it, something to do with social service.
Sort of personnel work,
sort of personnel work, yes.
I see.
But she was absolutely, she was very, very keen on processions and all that kind of thing.
Was she good looking?
Yes, quite good looking.
She must have been, I suppose.
Very fair, she was very good looking.
Mm.
And
and good fun, was she? I mean, you call her Charlie, and that's
rather
familiar.
Oh yes, she was
familiar.
Very popular. Well,
yes.
Everybody had a great feeling for her. They felt that she'd gone through a great deal. I know I did.
Mm.
But she was great fun.
What did she do in her later life then?
In her latter life?
Yes, I mean, during the war and afterwards.
Well, during the war, she was called upon to be a chauffeur to Lloyd George.
Of
yes,
course.
You see, and when the war broke out, some of our people, because we, only a very few of us were held back, a lot of our organizers were put into most confidential work in the government. That's what they thought of the suffragettes. And he wrote and said he wanted to have would we send him a chauffeur? So Charlie was sent. Charlie knew how to take a car to pieces and put it together again. She was very good at it. But I don't think she was awfully keen on it. She told me years afterwards that I, in the letter I wrote to tell her to go, that I put at the end, P.S. Brakes in order. She laughed at that. She said, you go to her. Be sure the brakes are in order underneath the P.S.
What happened after that then? She was a chauffeur, and then what happened? Did she get a job later?
Well, then she came out to America.
Mm.
Some of our members called Becks, who were very, they were middle-aged women who I think had a good deal of money. They were very fond of Charlie, and they gave her enough money to come over to America, and she stayed for about 5 years. But she also got jobs while she was there, and we saw a lot of each other then.
And then she came back to England.
Then she came back to England, and I don't know what exactly. Oh, she did some work, social work of some kind.
Did she? Yes.
Yes. And then she broke her leg.
Mm. Was she a religious person or theosophist like you, or
no? I think
like
she
that?
Was. No, she wasn't.
Mm.
She was a little bit New Thought, I think.
Mm. Because I hadn't come, she's another person I hadn't come across, you see, at all, Charlie
no.
Marsh, at all.
Well,
she
I remember two of her sisters. One was living in California at the time, and another one was over, and they came to have tea with me. And they told me about Charlie when she was quite young. They said, oh, you know, they said, she always had us all, lined us all up, and we had to march in when we were children. She was always leading the procession. They laughed about it.
It's marvellous. But we were talking about Mrs. Bartlett earlier on. Was she married then? Was there a Mr. Bartlett?
I never seemed to see any member of the family. I think he must have been died or something.
I see.
And she didn't seem to have anyone, but she was always turning up at times, difficult times, there was Mrs. Bartlett.
Did she actually have a position in the WSPU, or was she a volunteer?
Well, her position was really, no, not exactly.
Mm.
She was always helping, and she must have come in very, very early.
Yes, because again, I haven't come across her.
And she was very, very closely attached to Annie.
Mm.
And she was the first person, you know, every now and again I Again, it was in a sort of crisis and I wanted to know something. She turned up and said, oh, she could tell me something that I didn't know, I'd been away somewhere and so on.
What happened to her afterwards then?
I don't know. I think
you lost touch.
I imagine she's not living now.
No, no. But was she a Cockney? I mean, sort of East End type of Cockney, do you think, or what?
Well, she was. I don't know. I never think of terms of all these things.
Because there were some, weren't there? Mrs. Baldock, for instance. I don't know if you ever.
Oh,
came
she was
quite, her.
Wasn't she? Yes.
She was from the East End.
Oh, she was lovely. I remember I lent her a book in the very early days, and she was lovely. She used to pour out tea, cups of mugs of tea for us all, and we'd be coming in exhausted, you know, and all the rest of it. She was great fun. And she was very keen on philosophy. And I lent her a book called, nothing to do with philosophy at all, called Number 5 John Street.
Oh yes, and this John Whiting.
Yes. Mm. Well, that book was a sort of Bible to me. And I was, but he didn't really know, because he knew the money was behind him there, that he could go back to it. I felt it wasn't genuine, you see, in that way. But I thought it was a very interesting book and I lent it to her. And what is it she said about it? Oh, well, she didn't think so much of that. Me and my friend, who was it? Our friend. It wasn't Plato, but it was one of these people that she said she's gone back to her Plato.
She was quite a reader, was
oh,
she?
Oh, yes.
Was she really? Yes.
You see, there they were, everybody thought of her as this thing, and you know, as just an ordinary thing. She was a very clever woman.
Mm.
But she was quite covered up in the way she spoke and the way she acted, the way she talked and all the rest of it. But she was wonderful.
She had a little boy, didn't she? Young, yeah, about yeah. About 9 or so. Quite yeah. A young boy, didn't she? And a husband as well in the East End. Because there are books, minute books, of the East Ham branch.
Oh.
In the London Museum, and she's the major figure in
oh,
that.
Oh, she is. She would be, yes.
Yeah. She seemed quite a character when I read about
what
her.
What interesting things you've touched.
Yes.
How did you get in there?
Well, you know there's this big suffragette collection in the London Museum.
Oh, yes.
Well, there's the minute book from that branch of the WSPU is all there, you see.
Oh,
and
really?
She...
Do you
she
know who was secretary there?
Well, I don't know who was secretary, but she was certainly the major figure, and they obviously loved her.
Oh,
she was very popular locally.
Oh, very, very.
And they were awfully upset when she went to prison because they were worried about her.
Yeah,
you know, so it was really a rather moving thing.
Yeah.
But
she was very, very popular at the headquarters.
Was she? Yes. Yeah.
Well, she was a character, a real character.
Yes. Yes. But Louis Hadfield, we didn't talk much about Louis Hadfield. I mean, she was she a working woman as well, or was she?
Well,
like
I suppose they'd call her. I don't know what they call a working woman these days.
Mm. And what did she do before she joined the WSPU?
I don't know what she did exactly. She was married, and of course she
was she?
Yes.
Mm. And she joined as an organiser.
No, she really sort of came on to be with Annie and help Annie, and I expect she got something rather like that through that.
Mm. And she really lived with Annie, did
but
she?
But then she was at the last part, well, not all the time, I don't know where she went off to sometimes, well, then she was loaned to me for a bit, and then when I was in prison, she was at the... at Lincoln's Inn House, nearly all the time. There were very few people. She almost took over for them.
Did she really?
You could use people like that.
And it brings out qualities in people,
you
doesn't it?
You had
it?
People behind the scenes like that. People, well, they might have thought of them as working women or anything else, that they were very competent to carry on.
Mm. You see, again, unless you'd mentioned Louis Hadfield, I never would have come across her.
Who?
If you hadn't mentioned Louis Hadfield to me,
you see, because you see, she's really behind the scenes.
Mm. Mm. But very important, all the same.
Very important. You see, I feel that there are so many who played a very important part behind the scenes, and that nobody will ever know anything at all about.
Do you know what happened to her later?
She died in Canada.
A long time after? I mean, did she go straight to Canada after the movement finished?
Well, she went there somewhere about that time, and I must have gone to... I must have gone to America with Christabel. At any rate, I heard that she died.
Mm. Incidentally, one thing I did ask you, you might be able to tell me, is Annie Kenny's son still alive?
Oh, I knew there was something with him. He is, but he now.
Joan Cruikshank.
Joan Dugdale, and then her married name is Cruikshank.
I see. Nay, Dugdale.
P-K-S-H-A-N-K.
Yes. Well, that, and she lives in Scotland. And she remembers good on Pethick Lawrence's. That's interesting. I hadn't come across her at all. One thing that I was interested in, did the WSPU have a branch in Norwood?
Yes, I think they did, but I wasn't in it.
You weren't?
No.
But you lived in Norwood, didn't you?
Yes, but I didn't do any work in Norwood.
Why not?
Well, because, I don't know, there was... I knew people in Dulwich who were there, and... there wasn't a branch when I was there.
Wasn't there?
No.
I see.
And I was called to the headquarters. I mean, I just got called one thing and I was in it.
Yes. Yes. So you didn't come into the headquarters via a branch at all?
No.
Hmm. Because there are quite a lot of branches in London suburbs.
Well, you see, there? I know, because I had all these wretched things. All the correspondence in Chief Organised had to come through me. I sent all the letters out about the work that was to be done.
Mm.
There were 200 and something other branches.
Yes, well,
and
well,
there were a terrific number of organisers too through the country.
Yes. There were ever so many very strong branches in Kensington, weren't there?
Oh, Kensington was very strong.
Why was it so strong, do you think?
Well, I don't know.
It's funny, isn't it?
Interesting people there.
Yes.
But I think some of our branches were very strong.
Yes. Certainly you hear a lot about Kensington.
Well, you always will, yes, because the personalities there, you see, were unusual.
Yes, who was there? I'm just trying to think.
Hague.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
Lawrence
of course
Hague.
The people like the Brackenbridge came from that part, well, Notting Hill Gate they were.
Yes, yes.
And I don't know, there were a lot of people in Kensington.
Yes. I've certainly noticed it, you know, that quite a lot happens in Kensington.
Yes.
And the same with the NUWSS as well, actually.
Yes.
It's not just the WSPU, yes. I don't know why it is. It's curious.
I suppose they gravitate to rather intelligent people in that part.
That's partly it, yes, yes. I think there are probably a lot of unmarried women there too, with leisure.
So. Yes,
you know?
Yes.
I think that may have something
we
to do
with
it.
We had some very interesting people there, Pivot and Goodliff and Fargus and a whole lot, living close to the House of Commons.
Yes, yes. One person who you said you'd met was Hinchcliffe, the...
Who?
Hinchcliffe, the clergyman.
Oh, yes, yes.
He ran the Church League, didn't he?
Yes.
What sort of man was he?
Oh, he was a delightful man. He had a great sense of humour. Now, I can remember him having rather a big head in proportion to his body. And used to come down to Ipswich a great deal and speak for us. That's how I really knew him, but I didn't know that he was the head of the thing. And my members were always asking me if we'd have him down again. They liked him so much. Came to my rescue, because when they said, "What, we can't get a church, and what are we to do?"
For the
I said, "Well, do you think you could get hold of Mr. Hinchcliffe for me?" "Oh, yes," they said, like that. In almost a few minutes, he arrived. And I had no idea then. I didn't know till a long time afterwards his position. And through him, I got the church part.
He was quite a powerful man.
You know, it's very interesting, the people one meets. And the help they are, you never know. There's nothing that's happened to me in my life that I don't see as having in some way helped me in regard to the part I had to play in the vote. when I was about.
Everything sort of planned?
Yes. And a lot of things that I've done. For instance, I don't think I wouldn't have had the courage to play the part I did on the first deputation I went on. It hadn't been the fact that I had ridden horseback in Ireland.
Yes, yes, when you read the newspaper, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But I had, everything that's happened to me has happened in a very condensed way. I mean, it's a, and then it's, I'm out of it and into another part altogether. I mean, I just walk from one part to another.
Yes, that's interesting. You mean you saw everything of the WSP, you were very close to the Pankhurst, you went to prison, hunger struck, did everything.
Sometimes through a certain thing that had happened before that brought me back again into the picture, you know, it's interesting.
Do you say you're nothing, you quite often
what?
Say you're nothing, you say
yeah,
that
what?
you say you are nothing.
Well, I am nothing.
But what do you mean by that? I mean
well, people seem to think that somebody, I don't think I'm anybody, and I don't think I'm clever, and I don't think I'm anything, but what I do is, I think, well, now what do I want now? Typewriter, or typist, or I need somebody who can speak.
You're practical, you mean?
I'm practical. I just draw the people towards me. I'm nothing.
Well, how
and I had a very good, strong idea about this, that you should never hold a lot of detail in your mind. That's why I haven't got a good memory at all. Because I used to leave absolutely open so that the ideas could come to me that were needed. But you see, one time I remember some people, I saw, or some critical people, and they came to the office and I don't know, they complained that they'd asked me something rather, and that I rung up the information department. Cicely Hale came down. I said to her, what did Churchill say this morning? And it wasn't in the book that she generally sent down to me. And she came right down and handed it to me like that. And they went back to, it all went back to Christabel. And they said, she didn't even know that this thing had happened. So I said, what do you think I've got an information department for? She said, I can't have Grace Rose Bray cluttered up with all those things. You see, so many people clutter their minds with a lot of detail. But I would let it go through. And when I had Christabel coming through, as she did time and again in the most unexpected moments, the orders were, you have to send the secretary to the room immediately, sometimes if it was important, two or three. Every word I said had to be taken down in shorthand. They wouldn't know what's going on because I wouldn't take everything down, but everything I wanted to hold I had taken down and brought up to me. I then attempt to hold the thing so that the rest could come through and I wouldn't think. That was my way of doing it.
Yes, yes. But in a way you seem to look on your life as though you were a sort of instrument, in a way, as though you weren't doing anything yourself.
Well, I don't feel I am.
Who is doing it?
Well, I don't know who's doing it. It isn't me, I know that.
And you almost look on life as though you're guided all the way through.
Well, I feel guided. I feel very, very much guided in my life. Most extraordinary the things that I come to me. But it's not me.
So you've been guided by human beings like Christabel.
Call it fate or anything else. I don't know, but I can assure you that I knew just as well when I was a child that I'd got a part to play. Then I didn't know what it was. I did not know. After all, I was 18 or 19 or something other when Christabel was thrown out of the Free Trade Hall.
Yes. Actually, I wanted to ask you one thing. Tell me about your social life before you joined the WSP. You played bridge quite a lot, didn't you?
Well, I did. That everything was intense for a time being. While I was with my grandmother, I used to be always being asked. I was popular because I had so many men. You see, I had three uncles living with us and two brothers and a father. And therefore, little Gracie Rowe was a very popular person because she could bring so many men to the parties.
Yes, I see. Yes.
It wasn't me.
So you had quite a lot of social life, really, then, did you? I mean...
Well, I sort of grew up with a certain amount of social life, yes.
Mm.
In between.
Did your parents want you to come out at all? You know, people came out in those days, didn't they?
My mother died when I was 12, and I don't think my father thought much along those lines. And I was quite revolutionary in my outlook.
You didn't like the idea of...
Well, I would call that waste of time.
I agree. But I mean, not many girls of that age at that time would have thought that, would they?
But I was thinking all the time about what I was going to do, and when I got in the whole thing, very, very strong. And I think that a great many people who were being very real workers, who stood out in the movement, have had the same feeling.
A sort of destiny.
Yes.
Mm. Mm.
And it's interesting that it all came at the same time. There was a sort of impetus.
Yes.
And then you see another. I mean,
yes.
1912 was a very interesting time because of the Lansbury election. So many people went out and a new group came in. And the group that came in were very young. And the group that went out were the people who were... people like Moyes and all these people, they were out.
But where did they come from, these new people, do you think? What caused them to come?
How did they come? Well, they were, many of them were a very good family. But, you know, they were people like Joan Wickham and a lot of them were very good family. But there was no such thing as class with me. I never had a feeling about class. And the thing that I feel that did the most good of anything for bringing all the classes together and making them seem one was the Women's Munitions Procession in 1915. That seemed to bring everybody together, as they'd never been brought together before.
Because you'd always been a socialist, hadn't you, like your father? I mean, so it fitted with your socialist ideas,
yes.
Didn't it? Have you always stayed a socialist ever since?
I'm non-party.
Mm.
And I would say that if there was somebody that I thought a very great deal of, I thought was going to do something or get somewhere, regardless of their party, I would vote for that person and not
yes.
for the party.
Yes.
And more than I would vote for a party.
Mm. Because I tend to fluctuate. I mean, sometimes I vote Conservative, sometimes I vote Labour.
I feel very strongly, yes.
Mm. But, I mean, when you I suppose you cast your first vote in 1918, did you?
No, I didn't. No.
Because you were qualified then, weren't you? Or perhaps
I
you
wasn't
weren't.
Quite qualified when a thing came out. I forget what happened.
Mm.
In any case, I wasn't very strong at that time. I don't know where I was.
Perhaps you were in America, because you went... No, you went to America
no,
later.
No, we went to America in 21.
Weren't you with Annie Kenny in Hove or Worthing at that time?
No, St. Leonard's.
St. Leonard's, that's right.
Oh, no, that was over then.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
I just wondered whether... You were sort of loyal to your father's beliefs when you started voting later. Do you see what I mean?
No, I myself.
Hmm. Hmm. Fair enough. I mean, see why you shouldn't be. But I just wondered whether you...
He didn't understand a lot of things that I did, you see. Because I walked through everything and I've been in different groups.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, I can go along anywhere and people don't know what I think.
Mm. Mm. You adjust according to the situation.
Yes.
You can change.
Yes.
That's interesting. But Mrs. Pankhurst, of course, did change, didn't she? I mean, she, as you say, she'd been a Liberal.
She became
Labour.
In name.
Yes.
But she was the same all the way through.
Yes. You mean she was for women?
Yes,
all the way through.
All the way through, it was the same thing.
Yes.
And if Mrs. Packers could have stood for anything, I'd have backed her.
Mm. Mm. So you have you really were prepared to put your judgment in their hands, were you? I mean, you were...
No, I mean, I feel that she didn't change as much as people thought she changed.
Mm.
I don't think she did.
Mm.
I think that talking to her, she would have been any different to what she was the first day I met her.
Mm. And yet, I wonder whether her husband would have been surprised to find her a conservative candidate.
Well, you see, if they are, they're tied to a name, really.
Yes.
I mean to say, today, I mean, I know people who have been in the movement and they've done things and they don't object to voting liberal.
Mm.
Whereas I don't think, personally, I feel that I wouldn't do that.
Mm. Mm. Yes, my wife votes liberal, actually. I vote either conservative or Labour myself.
Yeah.
I vary.
Yeah.
But I don't support the Liberal Party myself. But
well, I think they're weak.
Yeah, well, so do I, rather. Mind you, it would be very difficult for you to support the Liberal Party, wouldn't it, with your history?
Well, I could do it myself, but I really think it's unforgivable the way Mrs. Packers was treated.
Yes.
And I feel that quite strongly, and I don't...
Does that still influence you in your attitude to the Liberal Party, do you think?
Well, I think that back of it, right back of it, there are people there who are... They're very clever at... keeping us out of things.
Mm.
And you think how very little women are being represented in this election even.
Yes, yes. Yes, I agree, really.
But, I'm very strong Labour over this.
Are you? Yes, I am too, actually. Yeah. I'm going to vote Labour this
anything
time.
I only hope that everybody is there to vote.
Mm.
My vote won't carry a vote, but... They're all very conservative here.
Yes. What makes you particularly keen to be Labour this time, actually?
Well, because I feel it's enormous what they've done since they came in. I think it's wonderful what they've
done. I agree,
done.
Actually.
And the most difficult... I think it's a downright shame the way the way they've been slurred in this election.
Mm.
And we've heard so much less of them than anybody else.
Mm. I quite agree.
And they've treated them very badly, and all this lying being talked about.
Mm.
And although I've had quite an admiration for some of the conservative party and Macmillan and these people, I may not have agreed with all of them, but there's quite a lot that I've had that I, you know, would liked.
Yes.
And liked them and enjoyed listening to them.
Yes.
But I don't enjoy listening to Heath.
No, nor do I. So you're still a rebel even now, are you?
Yes, I'm still a rebel, all right. I'm glad to know you are.
Well, I'm afraid I voted Conservative last time.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Because I think that the unions need to be in some way controlled or curbed.
Yes, but look, they've failed.
They failed, and so that...
Absolutely. Now, let's this other way and
I
wait.
I quite agree, absolutely.
They always want to talk about... We've got to take the thing as it comes. It may not come the way they want, but they're at least trying.
Mm, I quite agree with that. I mean, you can't go back to the old way when it's, as you say, failed completely.
And really, the things that Heath is doing now, really, his conceit, his colossal conceit.
Mm. Mm. No, I agree with that. I shall certainly vote Labour quite happily this time.
Well, what can your constituency?
I'm in Oxford, so it does matter because there is only a 200 majority in Oxford. 200 majority for the Conservative.
Oh, well, I hope you win out.
So we may win out.
Oh, good. I was thinking of you.
But you
see... Can give you my vote. Instead of having it here where it won't be much use.
But you see, my wife is going to vote Liberal.
She's going to vote Liberal.
So we're going to cancel each other out.
Ask her one day So she's read the history of the Liberal Party and their treatment of women. If the true yes. thing was given, it would be shocking.
Yes, yes. Yes, well, they wouldn't get many women voters, would they, I think?
Yeah. They say, oh, well, that was a long time ago.
Yes. So I was going to tell you something about Eat a Lamb, wasn't I? Let me tell you. I've got it written out here for you. I'll switch.
Very interested in philosophy.
Yes, that would fit. In fact, she was in prison at the same time as you were, I think. Her third imprisonment was in August 1913.
Yes, no.
And she went on thirst strike as well.
No, I didn't go in till 14.
14, were you? Yes, I see. Yes. But she was a writer.
Yes, I knew her. And I know some of the people who in the fellowship who, they absolutely worship her. I've got a photograph of her somewhere here.
Have you really?
Yes, and I remember her helping with the literature of the fellowship when I came over from America. And these girls, I never can remember their names, they're not girls now, they're women. They were always... associate me in some peculiar way very much with her.
Mrs. Mansell Moulin.
Mrs. Mansell Moulin, yes.
Remember her. Victor Duval, of course.
Yes. Now, he died in the election, didn't he?
I don't know, actually. I don't know about that, because it's a very brief memoir. It doesn't say... He stood for North Camberwell in 1924.
Yeah.
Certainly. Louis Cullen.
Yes.
Miss M. E. Phillips. I don't know who she would be. She was an organiser for the WSPU from 1908 to 1913. I don't know anything more about her. I think those are the only ones I've got here, but there are lots more. I mean, there are about 100. I mean, there are ever so many of them.
What are they doing with all that material?
Well, it's available to scholars to look at, you know, people like me to look at.
Yeah.
And they're keeping it beautifully. I mean, it's beautifully
filed
and well looked after and everything. It's very, very, very good place indeed.
They've got a tremendous lot of cuttings.
They have, yes, and lots of photographs.
Lots of photographs, yes.
Yes. Oh, it's very well run. It's much better than the Fawcett Library, I think.
Well, the Fawcett Library, there's been some changes taking place, I believe.
Yes.
I don't know whether it's for the better or
yes.
or not.
Yes. Well, the London Library is much better organised.
I'm glad to hear that. There have been great changes, I think, there.
Yes, yes. Anyway, I'm sure they'd let you see the collection.
Oh, I know they would. I've had correspondence with them, and yes. But I wondered.
But the biography of Eta Lamb is the best one.
It's a very interesting one, and I'm very glad to know it, because her name often comes to my mind.
Yes.
And although apparently she's only mentioned once in that book, I remembered she'd been mentioned.
Yes.
And...
Yes, well... It's interesting.
Yes.
I'm just wondering whether there's anything else I wanted to ask you before I went. I wrote down one or two things. Oh, Rachel Barrett you mentioned quite a lot. What sort of person was she?
Well, she was clever.
Yes.
Very clever. I forget what she got initials after her name.
Yes.
She was very, very charming and very... with a very intellectual look in a way, and quite revolutionary, very extreme in her socialistic views about things. She's a very good mind, and she was very, very helpful to Annie. She was right behind Annie when Annie was chief organizer, and she got arrested after that thing. I used to count on her very much when I arrived to understand it. Annie, and they used to laugh because I used to draw up what I wanted said, and then Rachel would put her head in the door and I'd say, here Rachel, add the highfalutin. And she was very, very reliable, and very close to Annie, very, very reliable. She was one of the people behind the scenes that did a very great deal more than anybody would ever know. And not at all strong. And I don't think she was able to do anything again after the hunger strike. But she was, she lived in, what's her name? She's a writer.
Not Elizabeth Robbins, was it?
No, or? No.
I don't know who that would be then. I could probably find
she
out.
She was very close to, she was, in fact they lived together, and this, the one that was with her, I think had a lot to do with helping her financially, because I don't think she was very well off financially. They were very close. What on earth was her name?
What sort of family did she come from, actually, Rachel Barrett?
Well, I don't know. She was very, very on the very highly intellectual and very highly educated.
Was she? Yes.
And very nice person. I like her. Very thought the world of her.
Do you know what happened to her afterwards?
She died.
Did she?
And but I think lots of people rather disapproved of her because she was very sort of communistic in her outlook.
Was she? Yes. Yes. She was in the office, wasn't she?
She was in the office, and she was really right in the inside, you see. And she was right behind Annie when Annie was chief organizer. And I met her long before. That is when I was telling you about how I was carried to the crowd by sailors. She was one of the people there.
Was she?
And I remember she was awfully under the weather and in bed quite a lot of the time. And I was so interested in her when I first met her. And a lot of the letters that came via Christabel when she was in hiding, and instead of coming to Annie, came through her. And I realized that she was very valuable indeed. And
she was a very trusted
person. Yes.
You mentioned quite a lot, actually, understudies. Did you have understudies for all the positions then?
No, we didn't, but we had to have understudies for the who was going to take over for to represent Christabel in England. I mean, I had a letter. I nearly died when I got a letter signed by Christabel. I took probably in pencil saying, keep this note, with Annie's arrest, you are my sole representative in England. If anybody challenges you, show them that note. I never had to show the note to anybody.
So it was only that position that was understudied, the position of being Christabel's...
Well, I consider that Rachel Barrett played what I call, she was in a quiet way, she was understudying Annie. She would be a person in her own right. And she was on the paper, did very, very good paperwork. And she was, in fact, when they were all arrested, she was actually, had got on her, lying on her desk, the Christabel's leading article for the paper which was coming out the next day. And the little office girl saw it, and they saw them arresting her. She snatched the paper and put it into her blouse. When I got down into the general office, this girl came up to me with flashing eyes and very flushed cheeks, and she said, Miss Rowe, I've got to lead her. She put it in that.
I see, I didn't realise that, you know, they didn't even have understudies.
Well, then it was thought out there were several understudies were arranged for, you see. A very great friend of mine, Olive Bartels, was my thing. We were together all the time, doing everything together. And she was a wonderful girl, and she came in for... But there was another one under her. She's still alive, and that was Harding. And she's in Canada now. And that's one thing about the these plays that they've just had. They never put in anything about the marvellous escapes that were done. I said to somebody who was challenging me about it, they said, well, why didn't they do any of that? Why didn't they show them not as organisers, but taking part in this wonderful thing that they were in? And she said, well, somebody said they didn't know how it was done. They didn't know. I said, that's a nice thing to say when the three people who did it are all living.
Yes. Who was Olive Bartels, actually? I haven't come
across Olive Bartels, you wouldn't hear anything about her, but she was, she came in, the whole family were in. Her mother was one of the early graduates. Her sisters were quite clever. One of them did a prominent work in, I don't know exactly what she did, but in government work. And I think the other one died. And she was an artist. And she was the youngest, very attractive. And I somehow got mixed up with the whole family, and I took a great shine to her. And I gradually sort of got her so that she could be an organizer. They were very badly off. I remember self-denial week. They didn't take any butter all the time to save the money for whatever it was they wanted to give to. And she came on then, and she and I were very close. And we sort of just almost knew what the other was thinking, you know, when you do sometimes. And it's very sad. She's quite blind.
Is she? Mm. She's still alive, is she?
Still alive.
Is she really? Yeah. But Bartels sounds foreign. It doesn't sound English. Is it, were they an English family?
I think she was Irish on one side.
I see.
She loved Ireland. She stayed in there too long.
How do you spell it?
B-A-R-T-E-L-S.
Yes, I haven't come across her.
Bartels.
Yeah.
She, well, she took my place while I was in, and she was disguised as a widow, and her mother used to go and see her. I think that was very dangerous, but she did. And then when I came out, Christabel asked me if I'd go to America with her, and I really felt I wasn't strong enough, and it would be very much better for me to be on the spot anyway. And I said, why not ask Olive Bartels to go? So Olive Bartels went, but Olive doesn't know that she wasn't the first one asked.
I see, yes.
But
yes.
As far as I know. But she went with her, and she had a wonderful time. She was a clever girl, very clever girl.
Do you know what she did earlier? I mean...
Well, she was an artist.
I see, and she didn't
go
to university.
She was very young. She was... I don't know how far she got with her art, perhaps not any further than I've got, as far as I know.
Mm.
But that's what she was doing. And,
Your art training made a great influence on you, didn't it? I mean,
I learned more about life than art.
Yes, you told me that last time. What do you mean by that, actually?
Well, I don't know. I saw life in a new way. I saw things that I couldn't have possibly seen if I'd just been living at home with the family. There were about 300 students there, and they were all, some of them were very good families and some of them were not, and they were all very different in their ideas, and I saw a great deal. I had a great, wonderful time.
So it was like going to university in a way, was it?
I remember they used to stay very long hours. We used to get down about 10 and sometimes not leave till 10 o'clock at night, and we used to stay over for a meal, you know, and then go on to the evening classes. And it was so funny, and we were all very hard up. And so I said, well, I'll go and do the shopping. And they said, I wouldn't dare go. I said, I'm only going to get 2 penny worth of butter. You can't ask for 2 penny worth of butter. I said, oh, yes, I can. And I had all these people in these shops, and I used to go down and I said, I want 2 penny worth of butter. They give me these things. But I had a